Welcome, everybody. This is Wise Talk, and this is our monthly leadership forum via Mariposa Leadership. Today, we are excited to have Dr. Alyssa Westring. Alyssa is an associate professor of management at the Dryhouse College of Business at DePaul University. She is an award-winning educator and an inaugural presidential fellow at DePaul. As the Director of Research for Total Leadership, she brings her expertise to evaluating the impact of total leadership on clients and program participants. She is a co-author of Parent to Lead, the leadership approach you need to parent with purpose, fuel your career, and create a richer life. She has co-authored many articles and chapters with Stuart Friedman and made significant contributions to this research in his books Leading the Life You Want and Baby Bust. Alyssa is also a scholar of diversity and inclusion with a focus on women's careers in STEM fields. Her work on women in medicine has been funded by the National Institutes of Health. She's a founding member of the Research Partnership for Women in Science Careers, and her scholarly writing can be found in numerous academic journals. She regularly speaks to Fortune 500 companies about creating organizational cultures that facilitate work-life integration, diversity, and inclusion. So thank you, Alyssa, so much for being with us today from North Dakota on vacation.
Yes.
So really appreciate
yes.
that.
It's my pleasure. We spent the morning hiking Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Oh, great. That's awesome. That's the wonderful thing about COVID. We've got, you know, there are some silver linings, and one of them is we get to explore national parks, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Your Twitter, so everybody would like to know that, is at Alyssa Westring, and that's Westring. As some of you probably know, we've been doing this show for about 15 years, and you know, I can remember back on the ones that were sort of stood out. And this one is definitely going to stand out given what I think that is going on right now. In our work, we are talking to a variety of people. But I have to say that parents, especially if parents of small children, are, as one person said to me yesterday, are crying inside. So as the school year comes upon us, this couldn't have been a more apropos time. We didn't time it for that, but it happened to work out that way. So before we get into some of these burning questions that I know people are going to want to hear about, as I always do, Alyssa, will you tell us a little bit about your journey and career path? I know that you've written this book and I've written a lot of things, but tell us a little bit of things that I didn't talk about in your bio, how you got
here. Sure. So, yeah. So when I was in college, I had already started thinking and worrying about work-life balance. And I know most people might say that that's a little premature, but I decided that it was something that was really important to me quite early on, and now I know that we don't always use the term balance. We can save that for a question if people care about terminology. But the idea was I wanted to research this topic and help people use research to find greater alignment between the different parts of their life and between what they care about and how they actually live their life. So I went to grad school to study this topic, and I started it about 20 years ago and have continued to love to do research in this area. And over the last few years, have really spent some time thinking about how do I go from just publishing academic research that very few people actually read to speaking to a wider audience. So that's why it's so nice to be here today and why we wrote the book. Because it's great to do research and it's fun to write for academic journals, but if it doesn't help anybody, then what's the point?
Right.
So
right.
So that's where my career has taken me. I teach business students and I teach them principles of management, career management, organizational behavior. I also supervise doctoral students and work with MBA students. So I get to be kind of the fun psychologist in the business school that teaches the really interesting stuff. So that's the other part of my job, has to do more on the teaching side. And of course, that's been affected by the pandemic as well. So, and then the only other thing I wanted to add is that I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. They're watching on their iPads in the other room. And so, for parenting, I'm also living it.
Yeah,
so,
that's good
to know.
This
is hard, yeah.
Yeah, that's good to know. And to come out with it, I have a 14-year-old, so we've got a lot of this covered here. He's going into high school, so not a good time to be going into high school. I think it's important that people know on the phone that we have kids, so we're living this for sure. So let's start with just generally like work-life integration. Obviously, you've done a lot of studying around this, and I'm going to just go right into like how are you seeing people. So this could be anyone, not just parents, but how are you seeing people work on self-care during this pandemic? Let's just go right to the pandemic. I'm not going to go too much more general than that. I just want to get right to it.
It's hard to think about what life was even like before. I think that it is helping people. Well, first the positive side, right?
Yes.
We are being forced to make choices about how we spend our time and energy that show us what we really care about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in many ways it's illuminating some of our priorities and helping us understand what we really care about, whereas before it might have been easier to get caught up in climbing the corporate ladder or to being the perfect parent who has, you know, the beautiful birthday party with all of the, you know, homemade decorations or to being the one that cooks home cooked meals and your kids don't eat junk food. So I think in the olden days, exactly. In the olden days, there's this tendency, and I know that I experienced it as well, to in all the different parts of our life, sort of judging ourselves by the standards from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And when all hell breaks loose, you kind of have to think about, okay, what are my core standards? What are the things that are most important to me? And that's what we've been trying to convince people to do in our research for many years, right? We've been telling people you need to take a step back, identify your values, your priorities. And I think that this time is just bringing it into sharper focus for a lot of people.
So what are you seeing people focus on specifically? Like, let's take I mentioned self-care. We've been talking a lot about self-care with our leaders that we're working with. What are you suggesting to people around that?
Well, I think that we, you know, and I'll include myself in this, get caught up in this idea of what self-care should look like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it should be, you know, a bubble bath, or it should be a massage, or it should be, you know, like this version of what does self-care look like. And for me, I've really started paying more attention to my environment and my physical cues about what makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that that's what other people are doing is like, okay, sometimes what makes me feel good is going out for a jog, but sometimes what makes me feel good is watching crappy television, and that's what I need.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm hoping that people are starting to, you know, without all of the running around and the going to the gym classes and all of that other stuff out there, I at least have had more opportunity to really pay attention to like, oh, on the days where I get up and exercise or get outside first, I actually do feel a lot better on
mm-hmm.
those days. So I'm getting a lot more information about what my body likes and doesn't like, and my mind and my spiritual health. So I think that that's, you know, one piece of the puzzle. But I also understand that a lot of people are just trying to keep their heads above water and, you know, keep their jobs or find a job and keep their children safe and mentally healthy. And that, you know, if people feel like, oh, I don't have time for self-care, that's not that surprising to me. And I don't think we should make ourselves add that as a layer of, you know, now there's something else to feel guilty about.
Mm-hmm.
And instead to say, could I serve people better? Could I, you know, is there a way within my reality to make myself feel better so that I can be there for the people who rely on me?
Right. So one of the things that I've been focused on with folks is going outside. So talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do have a bias, I guess you could call it
bias.
Yeah. I know watching crappy TV is great, and I think we should do that too. But I think that there's something about, because we are inside all the time on Zoom, that making ourselves going outside, I'm saying 2 to 3 times a day, create an outdoor space at your house if you can. You know, just walk it. Like the first one that we first were in the first 2 months of this where, you know, you weren't even supposed to go to the park. I was just walking
mm-hmm.
out my street and coming back. I mean, I was just walking around the neighborhood just to get outside. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I work with people, we're asking people to come up with experiments which is just sort of like a hypothesis about a new way of doing things that you think might be better in all the different parts of your life. And a lot of the people that I talk with are thinking about how they can kind of get a what we call a four-way win across the different parts of life, but just like a, you know, a win-win situation by being outside, being with your family, getting moving, getting sunlight, you know, getting the peacefulness of nature. I think that's, you know, I think that that's revealing itself to a lot of people. And I know for me personally, this vacation, this wasn't the plan to go to Minnesota and North Dakota and be in the wilderness. But given the reality of where I live in, you know, in busy neighborhood in Chicago, this, you know, made sense. And I'm obviously continuing to do work, but I'm also spending part of my day outdoors hiking. So I think, you know, it's a way for people to get some peace and get out of their, you know, that one bedroom that they're working and sleeping and showering and doing everything in. So, you know, I can't imagine that there's people who would feel worse going outside, but I also would say, you know, it depends on your values, just like everything else.
You mentioned the four-way win. Could you explain that concept, and we're going to use that to apply some of these other things we're going to talk about.
So we and this is the work that I've been doing with Stu Friedman for about 15 years in general, and we spent the last 3 years focusing really on the experiences of parenting. But we asked people to look at their life in sort of four buckets, generally speaking. And for most people, those four buckets work pretty well. The career bucket, which includes current job, but also job aspirations, networks, mentoring. The family bucket, which is, you know, kids, but also extended family and relatives. The community bucket, which is friends, neighbors, and then broader community, whether it's community organizations or political groups or social movements. And then the last domain, which we've already touched on, which is the self domain, which is the mind, the body, and the spirit. And the idea is to start getting better at understanding how those four different parts of life impact one another instead of seeing them as totally separate. And then also to, when we think about how could we make things better, to not just think of a traditional trade-off where, okay, if I want my career bucket to be better, that means I have to sleep less or, you know, be a worse parent or lose my time with my friends, and instead to look for four-way wins, which benefit across multiple domains.
Yeah, I like it. I like the integration of it. Because I think there's like this mental model is like it's separate. This whole idea of work-life balance already sets it up as a mental model of like one or the other, and that's why we try to use the word integration. And so now you've got a four-way, which I like a lot. So let's get into the aspects of parenting. You know, again, we're hearing, as you are, just all sorts of stories around in all domains of people who are having a really hard time with having their kids at home because they're trying to work. And so there's a couple things going on. One, there's people who are at home and their kids are at home, and then there's people who are needing to go to work because they're on the front lines for whatever reason, because they're in healthcare, because they're at the grocery store, because, I mean, there's numerous things, restaurants, hospitality, numerous things they could be doing. So we have two different issues, really. So let's talk about just what are you suggesting to parents? There's a lot here, right? But what are you suggesting to parents as far as, let's talk about boundaries and schedules, because I think that that's what I've been listening and reading a lot about, just making sure there's a schedule and being clear about that as a way to empower the kids, as a way to get them to, you know, be following something. And I know that with 5-year-olds that might be tough, but I think even for them, you can still get them to actually be part of the scheduling. So talk with us about the idea of how to sort of schedule this out, using schedules and boundaries as a way to cope with it. I guess that's probably the general question.
Yeah. So I think there's sort of two pieces to this puzzle. One is that, you know, the scheduling, it's just, it's a tool. right? It's a tool to help you see if you can be more functional throughout the day and live what you care about and have children and yourself be happier and healthier. And I think that the approach then I would take with scheduling is to try out a schedule or an approach to scheduling and see how it works. And then evaluate, gather data on your own life and look at your kids and saying, are they crankier? Are they able to get more done? How much screen time are they having? How do I feel about my work? Because, you know, you can go too far and make yourself miserable the other way too, right? Where if you have this unrealistic schedule and you're constantly feeling overwhelmed and behind and it's too much.
Right.
So I think kind of getting creative and feeling comfortable playing around with the idea of a schedule to find what works for your family, where it's not overly burdensome that you're planning everything out and everything is color-coded and, you know, children have to be in the mood to do a certain thing. I'm
right.
speaking because I've been there, right?
Yep.
So it's finding, it's knowing that you're not going to try one schedule approach and have it be the perfect fit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely you may have to iterate on that process till you find something that seems to work for you and your family. And
right.
it may work for a month and then stop working and you
right.
may need something different. So, you know, it's more that spirit of creativity and playfulness that we really try to encourage, even
mm-hmm.
if it doesn't really feel playful. And then being compassionate with yourself and with others when it does or does not go according to plan.
Right. So I kind of led the witness there with the scheduling. So let's go reel it back a bit, and then I want to open it up for questions. So what are some other things that you're suggesting to parents? I mean, it could be anything at this point, but think about as far as being able to juggle this, being at home and and having the kids there.
Yeah, I think, you know, the big questions are sort of, what do I have to do, right? Not what do I think I should do? What am I telling myself I should do? What do my kids think I should do? But what do I really have to do? What's the bare minimum I need and my kids need?
Yep.
That's sort of one piece of it. And then the other part is, what do I care about? What are my values? And there's some, you know, I just spent days grading student papers. If I said, well, what are my core values? Is it grading essays? Not exactly, but it had to get done.
Mm-hmm.
But did I have
mm-hmm.
to write pages and pages of elaborate feedback for each student? Well, maybe, maybe not. So I've been thinking about it, and this is just my own framework that I've applied to this, which is like, what's my minimally viable product?
Yeah.
What's the least I can do to get by at work, as a parent, and my partnership, in my other relationships? And then it's a bonus if anything else gets done above and beyond that. So I'm trying to kind of lower my expectations of myself and others and then treat everything else as icing on the cake. Like if my kids aren't on technology all day and they get outside, great. Look at me. I'm doing so well. So I think that's a helpful mindset because I know, you know, and probably a lot of the people listening tend to be more perfectionists. And saying, what's the best I could do at work? What's the best I could do as a parent? And by reframing and saying, okay, what absolutely has to get done in order for me to keep my job, keep my children safe, healthy, and happy, you know, and keep my, you know, my bills paid. And then everything else you get to kind of
Gravy.
Enjoy above and beyond that. Yeah.
I mean, that mindset right there is huge because I think that one of the things that my coach told me a long, long, long time ago when I was, you know, this way before COVID, just parenting in general, was that, you know, you have to just do enough. Like, you don't have to be perfect. And I actually don't kind of orientate toward perfectionism. I'm more like, okay, how creative can I be? So it's a little bit different. But but he's just like, you know, he just sort of calmed me down. He goes, you know, you have to be enough. Not, you don't have to be perfect and you don't have to be even great. And I think that what you've talked about here is really important because we do need to look at, it's not going to be the end of the world if the kids don't get all they need to get from school. They're not. They're not. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. I'm expecting.
Exactly.
I'm expecting worksheets. That's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting nothing more than worksheets. And like, okay, if that's what he gets, then we'll do those. He'll do those. But there's a whole host of other things that he's been doing that he's already on the course for doing that he'll do in addition to the worksheets. So if it's more than the worksheets, awesome. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So let's stop for a second because I want to. I'm sure people have some questions. And if you have a question, you'll need to *6, unmute yourself. And then what I suggest and ask is that you just say who you are and then ask your question of Alyssa. Anyone want to start? It could be a form of a case, like something's happening and you're dealing with the school or not dealing with the school, anything?
Hi, this is Sue. Yeah, the question that I wanted to ask was, so my youngest has a mild ADD and I'm concerned about how this, you know, homeschooling type scenario is going to work out with me being, well, both parents are, you know, working full time and he needs that one-on-one. What are, like, do you have tips on how to advocate for him with the school setting? He does have a 504, but not enough support from school. How do I go about asking for, you know, more one-on-one help, maybe even if online from the school? Because if I'm not there, he's just not with it. And I'm struggling to figure out how to best support him from home.
Great question.
Yeah,
Alyssa.
That is a great question. And, you know, I'll do my best to answer it, although I have to admit that this isn't something I'm an expert in. But I think that for some schools, they're, you know, talking about prioritizing the learning of students with special needs or those who would, you know, suffer the most if it's only online schooling. So I think, you know, reminding them that the science has shown that that is a top priority, that there are certain students who suffer more through online learning and that they should be getting extra support as needed. I think, you know, thinking about who at the school can advocate on your behalf is also an important question. So instead of, you know, just going to the head of the school, maybe you go to the learning counselor and they can then talk on your behalf to other people. And I think, you know, also as you speak to people, just sort of saying, I know you're trying. I know this is hard. I know you're doing the best you can for these kids. I just want to remind you over here that we're having a hard time or that we have special needs that the school is committed to serving. And letting them know what things they could do for you that you would like. You know, is it a half hour daily meeting with somebody or somebody supervising through the Zoom lens? And just asking for what you want in a way that acknowledges that they're probably trying their best.
Those are great tips. Thank you.
And
thank you. And I just want to say, you know, it's a hard situation. I don't have the answers by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay. What? How old is your child?
So he's 11.
Okay. So so my kid has ADHD. So this has been certainly up for me to work with him on this. He's 14, though, so a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just say this, that I actually think that for Max, that not being in school has actually been better for him as far as his learning, because he's not distracted by all the things that school distracts you by. So that is something to think about. That could not maybe be the situation with your kid, but I think for some kids that are typically distracted, this actually could be a, you know, positive thing. So
yeah, I agree that definitely giving him that one-on-one attention does help. It's the fact that we, the parents, aren't able to do it, and that's where I've been seeing you know, the most success happens, when, you know, if I'm sitting by his side and he does give me his attention. So
right.
Yeah, it's definitely a new reality for all of us. So we're gonna have
definitely.
To figure it out for sure.
Yeah. One thing that we're all kind of negotiating is this idea of, like, what does success or keeping up mean in this context?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what standards are we, you know, holding our children to, and what's really going to happen if they quote unquote fall behind right now. So, you know, is it like my kids, my daughter got to the point where she downloaded Duolingo and started teaching herself Spanish on an app because she was bored. That wasn't a school success marker by any stretch, but it represented a different kind of success and a curiosity and an independence of learning. So I think also just kind of saying maybe success looks a little different this year, and it's not getting every worksheet done, but it might be doing an independent project on something that they really care about.
Yeah, I want to echo that. Max did the same thing. He actually downloaded Japanese, started doing Japanese on Duolingo. So he actually, I let him be on screen from 10 to 3:30 every day, and different apps. So he actually is using those apps and deciding if school has him do things. So when school is in session, they had him do things. But now in the summer, he actually is doing things on his own. So he's on 5 different apps every hour he shifts. So I'm pretty, you know, excited that he can do that. And I don't think he's spending the whole hour on it, frankly. but the fact that he chose some of the apps, some of them were from school. One platform we really like is IXL, and that's Spanish, or that's science and math. There's of course Khan Academy, and then Duolingo. There's also a thing called Quizlet. So there's definitely apps, and sometimes the kids will, yeah, do it on their own, and sometimes you have to sort of sit by their side and say, okay, so let's start this one, and then let them do it for 20 minutes or half an hour, and then report back. So that's the rhythm we've gotten into, and it took a while. It took about 2 months to get into that rhythm, and now he's getting a little bit bored with it, so now we have to sort of shift it up a bit. But that's why I'm pretty big on schedules, and as you said, Alyssa, just like as you iterate on them, how do you create something new? So Sue, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's all great insight. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Okay, so let's is there anything else, Alyssa, I want to talk a little bit more about the school part and working with the school. Is there anything else you want to say about that? Then I want to get into like how parents are, how we lose our shit and how we deal with that.
You know, I think, and we can get to this whenever you want, but one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is this idea of how do we cope with uncertainty? Mm-hmm. Because I think if I knew what was going to happen, I could have then at least deal with that reality. But not knowing how things are going to play out is a very unique parenting experience, I think, right now. So if you want to talk about uncertainty or what we can do about it, I think that that's just another area that might be on people's minds, even if it's not in like a concrete way.
Sure, we can talk. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about all we know right now here in San Francisco is the school is opening online. That's all we know. We know nothing more than that. And I know a lot of parents, in fact, teachers don't even know what they're going to be. I know teachers that don't have any idea what they're going to be doing. They don't even know what platform they're going to be using. So talk about uncertainty. There's a ton of it. So let's.
I don't know whether my kids are going to school or learning online or some combination. I have no idea.
Still.
What?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about that uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's all around it.
So I think what I started to notice was that, you know, once we got into the swing of online learning, I was like, okay, I'm in this mode, I can handle this. And then once we got to summer, I was like, okay, I'm in this mode, I can handle this. But as fall's been approaching, it's this wondering, and I found myself like researching, will schools open? What schools are, you know? And so I think sort of noticing that some of the anxiety might be about just not knowing or the lack of certainty, and focusing on how do we cope with that, as opposed to how do I try and solve these problems of, you know, that I wish I could solve, like, you know, who am I, what's my kid going to do? Where am I going to be? You know, I think we have this tendency to go into what's called problem-focused coping, is to trying to solve the problem. And instead, some of the times we might need to take a step back and really focus on how do I manage my feelings? And I know for me, this particular moment in time with this uncertainty, I kind of had to say there is no work to be done right now until I figure out what's happening with school. the only work, the only solution here is dealing with how I feel about it and how my children feel about it, and talking about how, you know, not knowing can be difficult. Kids need to know that too, right? They want answers. So talking to our kids about how it can be difficult not to know, but that no matter what happens, we'll be okay, and we'll, you know, we'll find ways to make each other feel good, and we'll find ways to learn. So kind of confronting that anxiety about the unknown head on and bringing it up to the surface, I think could be a useful tool in the weeks ahead.
Right, and the idea that not only is there going to be uncertainty, but there's going to be changing constantly. Like, oh,
exactly.
maybe some schools are going every other, you know, like they're doing 2 days a week and they're allowing people to go in, but then somebody gets COVID and then that changes. So
exactly,
there's going to be that going on. There's going to be a constant stream of
right.
uncertainty, of change that are kind of go hand in hand.
Right, and I think for busy working parents, the solution that we often default to is sort of controlling and scheduling and making everything more rigid. So this uncertainty is kind of forcing us to take a different tack and to see how we can approach not planning and not knowing.
Right. And also I think the other tact also would be is that make some assumptions about our own work that we are going to be at. I mean, this alone may help. That we are going to be at home, or we're going to be working from what I'm calling working from anywhere for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it may not be the case that we're able to come back earlier than that, and that school will be able to come back earlier than that, and that's a bonus. But if we go into it thinking, oh gosh, we are going to be doing this for a year, and how are we going to, which seems overwhelming. I mean, it just does.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it feels like it's we put a stake in the ground and say, all right, if that's the case, then how do we do this?
Mm-hmm.
How do we work with the school? How do we get our kids on other systems that the school's not going to provide? How do we get, if we can afford it, tutors to come to the house or have a pod of kids with tutors, you know, outside so it's safe? How do we do homeschool? I mean, there's that, I think, puts a different sort of spin on it, if you will, or a different, but a mindfulness, around it.
Right, and that's sort of like that this is going to require creative solutions, and it's not going to be obvious, and we're going to have to keep working at it. To me, those are helpful sort of reminders. And that, you know, the book that we wrote is all about how to act like a leader as a parent and how to use leadership skills to make things better for yourself and for your family. And if you think about a leader of a company, a CEO going through a crisis, they wouldn't, you know, focus on all the negatives. They'd prepare for different contingencies and they'd inspire the people around them and they'd, you know, re-hone in on their mission and their values as a company. So we can kind of take some of that and think about how we can lead our family through this time, as opposed to being so reactive to
right.
all of, you know, the news of the day or the fear
right.
of the day.
Right. So somebody just brought up, just texted me a question that is perfect because I was
mm-hmm.
going to go into this as well. What we've been talking about is a lot of the academic aspects of school and the worksheets
mm-hmm.
and the platform
yeah.
and the, you know, can you imagine, especially in high school, it's like you've got six different teachers and you're going to have six different emails and it's going to be chaotic as far as like
yeah.
what the hell are we supposed to be doing. I mean, just learning how to do a Google Calendar, I think, is going to be hard enough for a kid with
mm-hmm.
ADHD, but whatever. So let's talk about the emotional and social aspects of it, because I think that a lot of people from the CDC, a lot of ex-head of education, Arnie Duncan, I mean, they're proponents of having kids go back to school, not just because of the mental aspects of it, but because of the emotional, social aspects of it. So speak to that. Assuming we're not going to be going back to school,
mm-hmm.
at least for, let's say, this semester and maybe for the year, how do we help kids with that social and emotional aspects of this?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's such a complicated question because part of this has to do with the risks that you're willing to tolerate in terms of exposure of other to other kids, you know, the pods, the micro schooling, all of that. And that's not an easy decision to weigh out what the risks are and what they're not. I was reading an article recently by a psychiatrist who pointed out that there's social and emotional risks of sending kids to school and to putting, you know, them in situations where somebody that they care about might get very sick. So I think about, you know, emphasizing the potential social benefits that we could have, you know, whether it's Zoom lunch dates or, you know, pods that meet outside or hiring, you know, a tutor. I think all of those things, they just have to get weighed against your values, your risk tolerance, and what you need to do in order to get your job done. I'm in a position where I'm a tenured faculty member. I'm not going to get fired. So what do I actually need to be doing? If I'm working less than my ideal, for me, that's probably okay. For somebody else who is a doctor seeing patients, that doesn't cut it. So again, sort of trying to come up with creative solutions that weave in those different pieces of the puzzle while realizing that, you know, our children are resilient. And if they are loved and supported and they, you know, are just seeing friends on Zoom, most likely they will be okay. You know, they'll be fine. We'll get through this. So, you know, I personally have formed a little, over the summer, we formed a group with four families that of kids that get together, and we hired a camp counselor, and that worked with our risk profile. And we, you know, I had to have some tough conversations with different other parents and with the counselor, and you know, that required some skills that I hadn't necessarily, you know, developed before to talk about, you know, negotiating what we're all doing in terms of safety. But I'm planning to hopefully continue that same cohort of kids into the fall, knowing that that there is a level of risk, and that level of risk is okay with me. I could totally understand why other people wouldn't feel comfortable with that.
Right. I think that we in things we're doing as adults, whether it's seeing our own friends, dating, you know, any of that stuff that we're trying to do socially, it's hard enough to do that, much less try to figure out for our kids. Like in our case, for example, I have people over here all the time outside. So I would say pretty conservative in terms of my, what you call the risk profile. I would say I'm pretty conservative. But feel very comfortable with outside. So, and that's probably why, and this is something else to think about too, in terms of kids who are older that are, and asking them whether they want to go to school or not. So talking about what you had mentioned, like if Max could go to school, he would choose not to. So, and I also, that's how I feel as well. So because of the risk of aerosols and lack of ventilation and all that, that's my primary reason, which is the same reason why I only do stuff outside here. But other parents have different ideas around that, right? Like they're not necessarily going to have somebody come over here because they're not sure what's going on. And so there is a lot of conversations we have to have that we have never had to have about, oh, gee, we're an ice cream shop in Sausalito and it was getting crowded and I had to ask some people to move outside. And that was hard, you know, to do. But they were cool. They're, you know, because it just got to be a little bit too crowded. But we've had to have conversations that with each other, with other friends, with our kids that we haven't had to do before. So any advice about that, about being able to be brave and courageous to be having these kinds of conversations that might piss somebody off?
Yeah, I think that framing it as a courageous conversation is incredibly important rather than an uncomfortable conversation.
Right.
And to think of yourself as sort of, you're helping the people around you by initiating the conversation because they may be too scared to do it. Another piece of the puzzle that you didn't specifically mention, nor did I, is talking with your parenting partner. If you have a co-parent,
right?
You know, you even within your own household may have different levels of risk tolerance. So how do you negotiate that? And again, you know, and in developing the book, we worked with parents. This was pre-pandemic. But how do you talk about what are our shared values versus what are our unique values, right? And if one parent, for instance, values safety much more than the other, that's a difference that's going to come into play when you're making decisions about risk. But by identifying, here's the value that we are talking about, which is safety, and here's how much emphasis we each individually place on it, and then here's this other value, you know, spending time with people that we care about. And we may, you know, place different value on that. So when we're deciding to go talk, whether we should go visit grandma, we're not just talking about whether that trip is a good idea. We're talking about how much we value safety versus spending time with family.
Yeah.
And I think uncovering those deeper levels.
Yeah.
Uncovering those deeper levels and having conversations where you acknowledge value differences sometimes makes it gets over the hump of just like, why won't you do what I want? Why won't you just do what I want to do? Which is what I say to my husband sometimes. I'm like, can we just do what I want this time?
So I think this is really important because I think, and I'm going to give you two examples, and I'd like you to comment on them. One of them is you mentioned that you're a partner that is, you live, you know, your partner in crime, other parent you live with, but then there's the issue of divorced, separated parents.
Oh, yeah.
Who may have very different ideas because if in my case, my kids are going back and forth, we live 4 minutes from each other, so it's easy. He actually uses that as an exercise to run back and forth. So we've worked it out, and it turns out we do have a very shared value around our safety. But I mean, man, if you didn't, if you don't, it's really difficult. So, I mean, does the person who has more conservative values win in that situation?
I don't know. That's a good question. If somebody who's listening has the answer, but to me that makes sense is that you go with the safer person's values. On the other hand, you know, I'm seeing that there's, you know, parents who are riddled with anxiety and transmitting overly cautious fears to their children that are not in line with what the government and the science is telling us. So I don't know the answer. There has to be some kind of balance because, you know, you don't want your kids going too far into being afraid of everything.
Exactly, being a germaphobe, yeah, for sure. Another example, again, these are real examples, so I like to use them. My brother got married, going to high school in COVID and getting married in COVID are just odd, odd things, right?
Yes.
So it's a long story, but, and so the question is, who's going to be, this is in Los Angeles, who's going to be in the little tiny space? Because you can't get married in court anymore, right? You have to go to these little places that allow you to get married. So who's going to be in the tiny space? So he said that, oh, yeah, mom's going to be able to come. And at first when he said that, I said, oh, that's great that mom gets to come because isn't that wonderful that she gets to see you get married? And then I started thinking about it going, wait. Like, mom should not, 80-year-old mom should not be in a space that's not ventilated, like, after there's been 10 people that day that have gotten married. So I called him back and I said, you know, I'm thinking about this. I think I'm a little concerned. I said, I'm not going to worry about you. That's not my purview, but I can worry about our mom. That's how I positioned it. Like, I can give you my thoughts about our mom. And it turned out it was a really tough conversation because it's, you know, it's his wedding, you know. He and his now wife agreed. And so it turned out my mom didn't go to the little space that's not ventilated, but she went to the after party that was outside. So it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a tough conversation to have with your brother that, you know, wants his mom at his wedding. So it was a Zoom wedding, so everybody got to see it on Zoom as well. But these are the kinds of conversations that we have to have, and I think that they're – and I do this for a living, and I think it's hard.
Yes.
It is hard.
I agree. And I think – you know, the lesson, hopefully, that we'll take away from this once things, if ever, go back to normal, is that we should be having these conversations anyway, right? We should be talking. And part of, you know, the program that we've developed before COVID was about talking to the people who matter most to you in all parts of your life, that you should be having conversations with your boss and your coworkers and your subordinates and your partner and your friends about what do we care about, where, you know, how do we support each other. Right, you're probably well familiar with encouraging people to have difficult conversations. So maybe that's something that we take from this is that, oh, well, now I know I can do it and the world doesn't end if I get embarrassed. You know, as we've been thinking, you know, and similarly, you know, as the political world around racial injustice and police brutality is becoming more and more of the forefront, I think many of us for the first time are willing to have difficult conversations about race and social justice. And it's the same thing. It feels a lot safer to avoid it because you risk upsetting people or saying the wrong thing. And, you know, my own experience this year is that it does take a degree of courage to have those conversations, but in the end, you learn you can handle that.
Yeah,
and, you know, you can screw it up and get criticized and be okay on the other end.
Right, exactly. So there is, thank you for that. There's a question that came through on the chat. I think is a great, I love this question. Can we talk about unsupportive managers? In the beginning of the shelter in place, my manager told me not to bring attention to the fact I'm working less than my coworkers who do not have kids. I mean, this is a great question.
Yeah, is there more or did you just comment on
that's
that?
That's it.
That yeah.
I think that there's a question. I think, can we talk more about unsupportive managers? I think it's a major
I think we, you know, we should talk about unsupportive managers, and there are bad bosses out there. And, you know, part of it is recognizing when we have control to lead up and to influence our bosses. And part of it is, you know, acceptance, just like we have to accept with our family, people aren't always going to act the way we want them to. So thinking about, you know, where can I control this and how do I create a sense that I am working in a fair workplace, right? I think that the reason why a manager might want you to not talk about it is because it might be perceived as unfair to the coworkers without kids. That you're doing less than them. And I think that that's a legitimate concern on their part as well. So how do we talk about these things in ways that help us do more work and better work and to keep sort of what are the goals in mind and as opposed to how many hours are each of us sitting at our desk? And I know for the last many years, I've worked fewer hours than most of my colleagues. But I also know I'm performing at a level that's just fine relative to the standards and the definition of success that I hold and that my institution holds. So I think trying to focus on meeting expectations and understanding what success looks like and defining it in that way versus just sheer number of hours behind the computer, you know, could potentially be helpful. And then where can you and your manager align on, you know, shared values, shared goals, shared definitions of success can be helpful. But again, part of this is like, it could just be a sucky situation that you have to get through until you can get out of it.
Right.
So, and you know, there's both pieces of the puzzle.
Right. And working less is not, I mean, certainly running around, you know, flaunting you're working less is not something you probably do. I think it'd be maybe if you were talking about anything, it'd be working differently, like working weird hours, for example. Like if you've got 5-year-old kids, maybe you let them sleep until. I mean, I actually purposely let Max sleep. He's obviously not 5, but I purposely let him sleep till 9:30 or 10, actually 9:30, so that I can get work done. So, and he probably doesn't mind that anyway. But my point is that how do you work it so that you do weird, you know, maybe you're working early in the morning and you're working in the afternoon late and you have, I know one couple who, you know, they've got 2-year-old, a 6-year-old, two and a 6-year-old. And, you know, one parent is on in the morning, one parent is on in the afternoon. And so that's how they're adjusting their schedules. And so then, you know, are they clear with their bosses around that? And being, you know, being transparent. I know somebody else who is a parent and who has a 200-person organization, and he basically instituted, we are having Zoom calls from 9 to 12 and from 2 to 5. That is it. All the rest of the time, your 12 to 2 time is parent, it's whatever exercise time, it's parent time, it's whatever you want it to be. Obviously, before 9 o'clock is whatever, same thing. So that, to me, of all the things I've heard, I think that that is the most, so the anti-manager, right? This is the anti, what the question asks. If you, not this is not a manager who who isn't caring. This is a manager who cares deeply. And that's what he came up with. And I think, and I applauded that. This is the very beginning. He came up with this, like, you know, week two. And it's proven to be super helpful. And he's got data to show it, you know, how helpful it's been. And so even if one is not a parent, one needs to be able to understand what parents are going through for sure. So that kind of schedule, I think, works out nicely. And, you know, I think there's a whole accountability thing we have to talk about. We don't have time to talk about, you know, in any depth here. But, I mean, how are you letting your boss know what you're getting done? Not because of how many hours you're working, but because you're getting the actual work done. So.
Exactly. Yeah, I think shifting that frame, because a lot of managers don't know how to judge performance other than hours worked.
Yes.
And if you give them other tools, you can kind of manage upwards to say, okay, here's the goal. By the end of this week, we'll be done with this. Who cares how, when, and where you do that, as long as you meet that goal. So, but they may need to be led to that.
Right. Awesome. Lisa, you've been wonderful. Thank you so much for all your tips and
ideas. Oh, my pleasure.
And
thank you.
I was going deep in terms of specifics, and you were going broad, and you continue to look at values, and I think that we've got to remember to do that. We've got to look at what are our values, how are those values being put in practice. So I really appreciate your perspective a lot.
Yeah, and it's my pleasure. And part of that is just really not wanting to say that I know best about how people should get through this.
Exactly.
And it's such an individual experience.
Certainly. Certainly.
You know, for people who are struggling, I feel you. It's hard. And do your best.
I do too. So again, you can reach Alyssa on Twitter at Alyssa Westring. It's Westring. Her website is totalleadership.org. And next time we are together is August 25th at 11 a.m. Pacific with Frances Free and Anne Morris. They're the authors of Unleashed, the Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. So again, we continue our series on stress. We picked stress management as our theme way before COVID happened. It just happened to be apropos. So I want to encourage everyone to listen to the tape, pass it to your friends and colleagues. I think this is going to turn out to be one of the good ones for sure. So thank you so much, Alyssa, and thanks everyone for joining us. And back to North Dakota and the little wilderness.
Yes.
Have fun.
Yep, got to go hike some more.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.